This is Thomas Kirsch, September 20th, 2013, the Kirsch-Jung Letters.
Thank you all for coming this evening. My name is Ann Taylor. I think most of you know me. And if not, I am on the program committee and the newsletter editor. So welcome. First, I'll introduce Dr. Thomas Kirsch and then perhaps just say a few words about the process of the program committee. Dr. Thomas Kirsch is a Jungian analyst trained in San Francisco. He is the past president of the Jung Society of San Francisco, the past president of International Association of Analytical Psychology. He received his MD from Yale School of Medicine and completed his psychiatry residency at Stanford. He is the consultant editor to the book C.G. Jung, James Kirsch Correspondence, 2007. Now, as the son of James and Hilda Kirsch, Thomas Kirsch will present insightful commentary on these letters, 150-plus letters, and tomorrow's workshop to stimulate an in-depth conversation and inquiry of this interesting relationship. And his books include The Jungians, A Social History of Jungian Movement, and just this past September released the red book, Reflections of the Liber Novus.
It just came out.
So please help me welcome Dr. Thomas Kirsch.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here in Seattle. I'd like to mention that I did my undergraduate work at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, so I'm very familiar with what the Northwest is like. I studied a lot there because it rained a lot. I don't quite know what I'm going to do with this lecture and workshop tomorrow. I haven't given thought to these letters for over a year. The book actually, excuse me, Anne, but it was published in 2011, so it's not been out that long. And it's going to come out in a paperback, and that's why somebody asked me if I had any extra copies of it, and I don't, because it costs $100 from Routledge, and I just didn't think I would, that would be a big sell, and I didn't want to drag all those books up here. And I don't know why it wasn't a paperback when it first came out, but that's it actually is not my book. It's actually Ann Lammers was the editor. Now, to me, it is quite amazing that the correspondence between my father, James Kirsch, and C.G. Jung has actually been published. And actually, there are a few letters from my mother to Jung. And there's a very interesting letter, which I probably will talk about tomorrow, that Jung writes to my mother when she is a patient of my father's, because he doesn't want to intrude on the analysis. That's just for starters. Okay? Now, the reason I say Jung wrote over 20,000 letters in his lifetime, and to this date, about 1,600 have been published. There's several correspondences. There's the Freud-Jung. There's the Jung-Pauli. There's the Jung-Schmidt about psychological types. There's the Jung-Victor White. And I think pretty soon there'll be the Jung Erich Neumann letters coming out. So that'll be five or six separate quarters. Plus, there are the collected letters that are in two volumes in English that were published in 1972-73, edited by Gerhard Adler and Aniela Jaffe. Now, Jung lived at a time when letter writing was an art and when people expressed themselves through that medium. So, in the collected letters, the two volumes, we have Jung's response, but we don't have what the writer wrote to Jung, so we don't have two ways. And this is actually the first correspondence of that of any of Jung's first generation of students of analysts. So, to me, this has been an important thing to do. And as somebody said to me after that first came out and said, "Well, you've really made your a debt, you know, to your father." Actually, what he really wanted me to do was to take his 300 tapes that he gave in seminars in Los Angeles on psychology and alchemy, the materium conjunctionis, and psychology of the transference, and write them up as a book. So this is small potatoes compared to that. Now, let me begin how this project came into being. My father died in 1989, and I was made the executor of the intellectual property. And at the time, there were 44 letters from Jung to my father. Some of them had already been published in either the collected letters or in the journal of the LA, Los Angeles Institute of Psych Perspectives. So I tucked the letters into a safe deposit box and thought I had nothing more to do with them, because I thought, you know, I mean, I'm separated from my father. That's it. But then there was a chance meeting, and a woman sandplay therapist named Sasha Rosen, a former Berkeley sandplay therapist now living in Kent, England, and she called me, and she said, "Tom, do you know that the complete correspondence of your father to Jung is in the Eteha archive of Jung?" And I said, "No, I did not know that." So there it was, and this was 2003. So I contacted the archive in Zurich, and contrary to my expectations, it took me 9 months for them to send me the letters. The Swiss also had to make cutbacks in government services, so that it took that long for me to get the letters. And then I had my secretary, who was Swiss, translate the letters into English. And that's when I realized that this was more than just for me alone, that there were some things, there were some topics that were covered that needed a more general exposition. So, number one, the first half of the correspondence is Jung's attitude towards Jews and his supposedly anti-Semitic views. These were strongly challenged by my father in his correspondence with Jung in 1934. And as far as I know, these are the only letters that Jung actually answers some of the questions about anti-Semitism and the Nazis. And these are the kind of questions that many of us since the last 60, 70 years would. My father asked Jung the kind of questions I think many of us would have liked to ask him, because it's been such a controversial and hot topic. Anyway, it was those letters that, when I saw that, that made me think that this material needs to get published because of its primary documentation. Now, in 1934, Jung also makes a statement, which I will read later on, about the nature of the unconscious and the relationship between the patient's unconscious, the analyst's unconscious, and what the interaction is in between. I will read you that paragraph later on. Today's interrelational psychoanalysis, which is a very influential branch of psychoanalysis today, could use Jung's statement verbatim from 1934. Of course, they don't like hearing that. Now, one huge shadow side of my father, and what probably brought him into analysis in the first place, was his over-involvement with his women patients. He could not seem to keep his hands off many of his women patients. My mother was one of those patients. Yes. So, now he had a large practice in Berlin, and when the Nazis came into power in Germany in 1933, she had been recently widowed. She followed, my father recommended to all his Jewish patients, especially, to leave Germany. He says it was dangerous. So he went to Palestine because he had been a Zionist in an earlier age. And he said that Hitler was out to destroy the Jewish population of Germany. This is 1933. Jung thought that my father was crazy to leave Germany, and that the Nazis would be out of power in a very short time. The boundary problem did not stop with his relationship to my mother, because he continued to have those kind of issues with other women in his practice, and I think it hurt him professionally quite a bit. And he finally, in the last 5 minutes, or rather the last letters between Jung and my father, he he kind of confesses the problem, and Jung scolds him, and actually is, that's one of the things, one of the many things that I learned from this was that Jung saw my father as a very creative and intellectually interesting, and had a deep relationship to his unconscious and to the spiritual side of his psyche. But he also realized that he had a lot of problems. And Jung, reading the correspondence, I realized that Jung took care of him. I mean, as his analyst and therapist throughout Jung's life. I'm going to begin a little bit, just give you a little bit more biographical information about my father. I'm not going to bore you with too many details, but it was interesting. He was born in Guatemala City in 1901. He came from an Orthodox Jewish business background. And you know there were many Jewish people who came. As we in San Francisco know many of the Haas family, the Levi family. A lot of business people came and started businesses all over the United States, but also Central and South America. And my father's father, because I never met him, was in the button business. But my father reacted against the materialistic bias of the family. So his mother brought the family back to Berlin, to Germany, in 1907, because they wanted the children to have a good education. And the father remained in Guatemala City, but he saw his father every 2 years, except there was a little thing called World War I, so he didn't see him for 9 years. And my father certainly had a hunch that his father had a second Indian family in Guatemala. So when my father met Jung became the father figure for my father for the rest of his life. He graduated from Heidelberg Medical School in 1923. And Heidelberg Medical School was the best of medicine in Germany. It would be like going to Harvard or Yale or something like that. He opened up a private practice in 1923, and he got into a Jungian lay analysis with Tony Zussman for 4 years. And then in 1928, he wrote to Jung asking if he would see him in analysis. And then there began the 32-year correspondence. I'm just going to mention this, that next year, next May 29th or something like that, the German Jungian Association is going to put up a plaque and unveil a plaque at the office, at the site of where my father's office was in Berlin, which is very moving. The actual building, of course, got bombed out in Second World War, but it's going to be, I'm all things being equal, I'm definitely going to go. Okay, now I've already said that my mother sought out my father as an analyst in 1932 when her first husband was dying from fulminating multiple sclerosis, and she was soon to be a widow with two small boys. By this time, my father was urging all his Jewish patients to leave. Now, my mother clearly had a strong erotic transference to my father, and she followed him, and he wanted her to follow. They first spent a month in Ascona at the first Aranos conference, where my father gets pretty upset with Jung, because Jung doesn't spend any time with him at this conference. Now, I'm just fantasizing myself. Here's Jung organizing his first Aranos conference. Here comes my father with his first family and their two kids, and here comes Hilda Silber at the time with her two small boys. And he looks at that situation and says, "No, I'm not going to get involved in that." And that's my sense of why Jung didn't. I mean, I don't have that. Jung didn't say that. That's how I interpret why he didn't talk to him there. So, my father was not happy. He felt that the fanaticism of the early Zionists in Palestine was as bad as the Nazism in Germany. I hope that doesn't offend anyone. And so he divorced his first wife and married my mother, and they moved to England in 1935. And I'm sure that he was prepared to spend the rest of his professional life in England, had not World War II come along, where it looked like, I mean, at the time that England got it, was attacked by the Germans, every other country had fallen very quickly. So he had these two uncles in San Francisco and got a quick affidavit, and we left on a boat. I can tell you that the crossing of the Atlantic, I was 4 years old, was pretty, we got attacked almost every day by German U-boats, and we spent quite a bit of time at the life rafts in case, you know, one of those attacks, you know, were successful. But we made it across. We had a big convoy. We ended up in Ellis Island, and they lost our papers. And I was questioned at Ellis Island by a reporter. I was 4 years old, and I was asked, because we were one of the first boats to actually make it across. The U-boats were sinking a lot of tonnage at the time. And I was asked how I liked Ellis Island. And I said, I like this hotel very much. So Werner Engel, who some of you may have heard of, who had made it already to New York, read that on the subway in New York, and so he saw that we had arrived. And so he came down and picked us up and got us out of Ellis Island. So anyway, that's New York was not very favorable towards my parents as analysts. And so they came to San Francisco and to see my dad's uncles. And on the way back, he stopped in Los Angeles and saw this wonderful wasteland. And it looked like Tel Aviv, where he'd lived, and all these wonderful beaches. And so we settled in Los Angeles and became the first Jung. And he and my mother started a Jung group in Los Angeles, which is the one that's still there today. So, okay. So that's basically a little history. Are there any questions that somebody would like to ask me now?
You mentioned your father bringing questions to you regarding his...
Yeah. Yeah. I will. Yeah. Okay, I will. I will do that. I'm not going to answer it now, but I will. Yeah. Somebody else? Ken.
Yeah. I was curious about your father knowing in 1933 that it was going to be bad news for the Nazis. And Jung was saying, oh, no, it'll be over in a matter of...
Yeah.
I'm wondering where do you suppose he had that kind of certainty about it? And I have a suspicion, but I wanted to ask you about it.
Okay. My father had a dream. In the first dream that he presented to Jung in his first interview with Jung in 1929, he said it was a very short dream and just said there's evil and then there's absolute evil. And that was the dream. Jung got up with his smoking pipe and walked around the room and got very disturbed and didn't say anything. That's one thing. When my father was 16 or 17, he had a vision. It was right after World War I, and he said there was somebody who should have been killed, but had remained alive, and he interpreted that to be Hitler. So, my father has made a lot of mistakes in his life, but one of his most absolute on, right on things was to leave Germany the day after Hitler came into power. I mean, he didn't leave the day, but he applied for to leave the next day. He went right to the
Did he come across the that Hasidic rabbi who wrote the book about the prophet? You know that book that he wrote.
That's too general. Oh, Rabbi Nachman, or no, Rabbi. I'm blind. You see, this is what happens with age. My dad wrote a book called The Reluctant Prophet. And it's about a rabbi in the 1880s who recommended that his whole congregation go to Palestine. And that's the essence of the book. It's a lovely little story. I can't remember his name now. But anyway, that book came out in the late 70s or early 80s. Any other questions? Okay. Now, I will get to your... I put this together from a lot of different thoughts, and I didn't know where to kind of... Okay. This is a letter that Jung wrote to... it's actually a letter my father wrote to Jung on May 7th, 1934. Jung... Well, I have to give you a little bit more history, is that... There was a general medical society in Germany and Jung was the vice president of it. And I'm blocking on the name now, but as soon as Hitler came into power, the man who was the head of this organization resigned and went back to a Catholic university. He was Catholic. And actually, he was the forerunner of the types of ectomorph, mesomorph, and endomorph. Shelton got it from him. I'm blocking on his name. Now, as Tom Wilkinson would say, it'll probably come up in about a half an hour. so Jung was asked to become the president of this organization. And... he did it reluctantly, and he made the condition that the organization now become international. And the first meeting of this organization was in Bad Nauheim in May of or April of 1934, and it's actually the article that everyone quotes when they want to say that Jung was anti-Semitic. It's called The Current State of Psychotherapy. It's in volume 10. And the thing that people don't like is that Jung says that there are different psychologies. There's the Chinese psychology. There's Jewish psychology. There's Aryan psychology. And they're very different. And what he says about the Jewish psychology is that they require a host culture and to really blossom, that they have never formed a culture of their own. Okay? That's the statement that gets psychoanalysts, whoever, Jewish people of all sorts, and they just want to say, slam dunk, forget about Jung. Because he clearly was a racist, anti-Semite, and the language is too similar to what the Nazis were saying about the Jews as parasites. Okay, my father has read that article. My father was living in Tel Aviv. and had seen had seen Jung the previous summer at the Aranos meeting, where Jung had no time for him. And here's what he says. First of all, I have to tell you that in Ascona, as well as here in Palestine, I heard reports about some of your remarks which did not present you as a friend of the Jews. At this distance, of course, I was unable to verify what you actually said. For instance, it appears that you said that Jews are not honest in analysis. Then, this is a psychoanalyst came to Palestine, Gustav Bali, appeared in Palestine, visited with all our colleagues, and stated publicly that you had openly crossed over to Hitler, that you had been received by him, and thus you are an anti-Semite. The result was that your books, which had been displayed in many bookstores, disappeared from the shop windows, and your name was placed on the boycott list. Goes on. Well, dear doctor, the rumors about your being anti-Semitic do not appear to be dying down. In a letter I received from Germany last week, someone wrote me that you had expressed on the radio via German broadcasting stations your gratitude for and recognition of Hitler's reforms at the German universities. Hitler got rid of all the Jews in teaching at the university, and then, of course, they burned all of Freud's books. If that is a fact, I do not understand how you, as a Swiss, please don't interpret my letter as being aggressive. I am merely attempting to understand you in this respect and hope that you will grant me the privilege of reaching such an understanding. On the other hand, I don't feel understood by you in this matter. Later on in the same letter, about the Jews, you write, the Jew, as far as I see, will never create his own form of culture because all his instincts and talents presuppose a more or less civilized host people for their development. My father says, I am dumbfounded to hear such anticipation from you. But even the premises to this prejudice seem incorrect to me. What you are writing certainly is true for the Galut Jew. Now, I wonder how many of you have ever heard of the word Galut. Okay, that's interesting. Because I'd never heard of it before. And what it means is a Jew in exile. And, I mean, many Jews were in exile. And my father thinks that Freud represents that Galut Jew, although Jung doesn't agree with him on that interpretation. Now, I would like to, at this point, go over something which I think is very complicated in a way, and it's hard, and you can interpret it in many ways, and I'm happy to have your reactions. Okay, volume 10, this current state of psychotherapy. About the Jews needing a host culture has been open to many different interpretations. Some of them positive for Jews, and others demonstrating Jung's anti-Semitism. As this is the pivotal point of Jung's interpretation of what Jewish psychology meant for him, the issue keeps raising its ugly head today as to what Jung meant in 1934 by the term host culture. So, I'm thankful to John Beebe for this, because he looked up the word host and how it was used in Germany in the late 1920s. The German word is Wirtsvolk, And it was a perfectly neutral term and was found in the Yiddish lexicon, a four-volume reference work published between 1927 and 1930, and which was also found in Freud's library. In this context, host is an anthropological term. The Nazis used the term in its darker, biological sense, and then the word became parasitic. For the Nazis, the Jew was a parasite on the Aryan culture, and the Jew had to be eradicated. So the big question is, how did Jung mean the term host? It has led students of Jung, both those in favor of him and those against him, in a quandary of how to take the term host. We cannot be sure. But one imagines that Jung meant the term in the anthropological, non-Nazi sense. Or, I do not believe that my father would have accepted that what Jung had to say about Jews if Jung had meant it in the Nazi sense. Now, Hitler only assumed full power in 1934, and it was then that the term Wirtsvolk really assumed its full Nazi meaning. However one wants to interpret this sentence in Jung, one cannot come to a definitive interpretation which will satisfy everyone. Now, my father, when he first saw Jung in 1947 after the war, the first thing that Jung did was, I've got to stand up, my hip is hurting a little bit, so I'm going to try standing up, was to apologize. And Jung evidently was not happy what he had said in 1934. And my father actually wrote to Heinrich Fiertz, another first-generation Jungian living in Zurich, about what my father's experience of Jung was in 1947, that sense of apology. And of course, we know the experience that the rabbi Leo Beck, a very famous rabbi of Berlin, who was in Theresienstadt during the war and who had known Jung from the 20s, that when Beck came to Zurich in 1946, Jung called on him and he wouldn't talk to Jung. So Jung went down to his hotel and apologized for what he had written in the 30s. And that was very important because it was with that approval that Gershon Scholem agreed to become a speaker at the Aranos Tagung lectures. And before that, Scholem had refused. So do we have any more questions at this point? Yes, in the back. No. This was verbal. A lot of people asked Jung to... to write something. It's kind of like Pope Pius during the war in Italy. He has kind of a similar stigma attached to him. And the question was, do you defend yourself or not? Jung decided that he would not publicly, but he talked to his Jewish colleagues I mean, prior to World War II, Jung had probably between 10 and 15 Jewish clients who none of them ever felt that he was anti-Semitic in any way. What my mother said, actually, was that she was an assimilated German Jew. Her parents were professional people, and that it was through Jung that she became aware of what it meant to be Jewish. He made her aware of her Jewishness, so he brought her in contact with her roots. So, and that's what I heard growing up. Yes, over here. Oh, yes, he did. Oh, yes. But he didn't. I thought the question was in 1947 when he apologized, he didn't put that in writing. But he.
I'd be very interested in what he did
write that. Okay. Let's get the book. Yes. Yes.
You can say what that means, really.
The English translation is host. And it means, but I don't know how that, I haven't uncovered its meaning, you know, anthropologically, but that's how it was used. You know, you can talk about subculture, you know, different moieties and different cultures, and you know, there's a host culture and a subculture and this, and so that's how it was used before the Nazis got a hold of it and turned it into a pretty negative term. Yes.
Well, yet has the meaning innkeeper.
Innkeeper.
Yeah. A Wirt's house is an inn.
The term Wirtsvolk. Well, that is the impression that I have, that that's the meaning of the word. Wirtsvolk is different from Wirt.
Yeah.
But an innkeeper would be a type of host.
Right. Yeah.
An innkeeper would be a kind of host.
Benevolent host.
Yeah, benevolent, hopefully. In the back.
Do you think he could have meant that in all the recorded history that we have of Jewish people, this is how they have existed?
I got my hearing aids and I still can't hear you.
Do you think he could have meant that through all the recorded history that we have of the Jews, that Gentile people have of the Jews, they are usually the guests of others because they've been in exile for so long, so that he really couldn't see the Jews in an inhabitat, say, during the time when they actually had their own kingdom in Palestine and all of it. I mean, that's how I would see it.
Could you translate that?
I mean, you're saying it so very well. How about you just come up here and say it again? Well, I think it's a complicated. I'm just saying that. Well, he didn't study history, and all he could really know of the Jews was what was in recorded history as far as, you know, other cultures.
Yeah.
They'd always been, you know, kind of an exile from their own country, so that's all he knew about the Jews. I mean,
well, he didn't know that. What he knew about the Jews was from his psychoanalytic association with Freud, and all the Jewish followers that were around Freud, because he and Ernest Jones were the only two non-Jews around that early
movement.
Mm-hmm. And where did his friendship with Herlitz start?
Okay.
That was later?
Hurwitz, Janet asked about Zygi Hurwitz. And Hurwitz, this is an interesting little story. I knew them. Hurwitz was a dentist, and he was Jung's dentist. And actually, Hurwitz's wife, Lena, was the German editor of the Collected Works. I knew the Hurwitzes very well. I traveled with them, and he was born in probably 1901 or 19. He's the same age as my parents, and that'll come up later with this letter. But Jung actually asked Hurwitz to become a member of the Analytical Psychology Club in 1950, and there was still a clause in the Analytical Psychology Club of Zurich that there was a 10% quota on the number of Jews that could be allowed. Now, when you think of that, you know, by today's standards, now I know when I applied to medical school that I was going against the Jewish quota. I mean, all the major medical schools had that in place. And that only got taken out during my time of in medical school. Suddenly, the Jewish percentage of students went up from 20 to 40. So, I mean, you know, clubs, everybody had that, it seemed, at that time. So it looks awful from 2013 history, but it was very common. And what's interesting about the clause in the Analytical Psychology Club was that it was put in place in November 1944. So when you would think that, you know, that the looked like the Allies were going to win, and so anyway, it seems a little it was late, and Jung had nothing to do with it. It was C.A. Meyer and Tony Wolfe who put it into place. So anyway, when Hurwitz in 1950 said he wouldn't join a club that had that quota, Jung went to the club and said, you've got to take out that quota system. And they did. So that's little story.
It was only in place for 6 years.
Yeah, for six. That's right, from November 44 to whenever in 1950 this took place. Okay, any more? Okay.
I'm still not clear on Jung's response to your father by letter. Did he make a response to
your father? Oh, yeah, he did. Okay. I should know the page, but I... Can't I find it now? I'm gonna.
We can take a break.
You want to take a break? No, I know where I've got it now, but let's. Yeah, I found it. You would think, as many times as I've read these letters over, that I would not, but I don't. Okay, this is May. I should have. It's my wedding anniversary date. I should know it. May 26, 1934. This is Jung writing. I'm going to read the whole letter because you asked for it. My dear Kirsch, gives me great pleasure that you've written me again. See, they've been out of contact. It appears that amusing rumors are being spread about me. The only unquestionable fact which lies behind all of this stupid gossip is that as the honorary chairman of the International Society for Psychotherapy, I could not desert the society when, excuse me, when, now his name, Kretschmer, resigned. Okay? I was urgently requested by the German physicians to retain this position, and I've consequently done what anyone else would have done in my situation, namely my duty towards the International Society. Essentially, this consisted in preserving the umbrella organization and incorporating the German Society into it. This plan succeeded at the last Nauheim Congress, and we can also register the gratifying fact that at my suggestion, a special paragraph was adopted which makes it possible for Germans, for German Jewish physicians, to join the international organization as individual members, because of course they could not join the German society. Thus, they have become full members with equal rights. I need hardly mention the other rumors. It is a downright lie to maintain that I said Jews are dishonest in analysis. People must think me extraordinarily stupid if they think I could hold such an idiotic opinion. Neither have I addressed Hitler over the radio or in any other manner, nor have I expressed anything concerning politics. Jung tried to be very apolitical. With regard to my view that as far as one can see, the Jews will not create their own form of culture, this view is based, number one, on historical facts, and two, the additional fact that the specific cultural contribution of the Jew evolves most clearly within a host culture, where the Jew frequently becomes the very carrier of this culture or its promoter. This task is so unique and demanding that it is hardly to be conceived how, in addition, any individual Jewish culture could arise alongside it. Now you can think of certain prominent Jewish people in American culture. I think of certain musicians, Irving Berlin, Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, people, you know, who really represent American values, not Jewish values, but they are Jewish. And I think that's what I think Jung is meaning in this situation. This task is so unique and demanding that it is hardly to be conceived how, in addition. Okay, now, since Palestine represents a very unique condition, I have cautiously inserted, and he uses the German word, voraussichtlich, which means as far as one can see. I would in no way deny the possibility that something unique is being created there, but I don't know that as yet. I positively cannot discover anything anti-Semitic in this position. Regarding your suggestion that I write a special piece about this question, this has already been anticipated in that I suggested an exchange of letters with Dr. Neumann, who has worked with me and now also lives in Palestine, which would deal with all the contentious questions. Up to now, though, I've heard nothing from him. It's interesting, Neumann and my father lived just around the corner from each other in Tel Aviv and never saw each other. They weren't particularly friends. They knew each other in Berlin, but they didn't. They were never friends.
And they knew each other were around the corner?
Literally. Yeah. Now, I'll go on. It's a long letter. Jung makes a long response. And you can then tell me what your answer is. Okay, the Jewish Christ complex. This is something that Jung and my father talked about for 32 years. Is a very remarkable business. As you know, I completely agree with you in this respect. The existence of this complex predisposes to a somewhat hystericized general mental attitude, which has become especially clear to me in the course of the present anti-Christian agitation. The mere fact that I speak of a difference between Jewish and Christian psychology suffices for anyone to voice the prejudice that I am an anti-Semite, or in the opinion of the Schweiz, Israelitische Wochenblast. For instance, my assertion that I'm just as little an anti-Semite as an anti-Chinese proves my intention to compare the Jew with a Mongolian horde. This sensitivity is simply pathological and makes every discussion almost impossible. As you know, Freud previously accused me of anti-Semitism because I could not tolerate his soulless materialism. With this readiness to snuff out anti-Semitism everywhere, the Jew directly evokes anti-Semitism. I cannot see why the Jew, like any other so-called Christian, is incapable of accepting that he is being personally criticized when one has an opinion about him. Why must it always be assumed that one wants to condemn the Jewish people? Surely the individual is not the people. I regard this as an inadmissible meaning of silencing one's adversary. In the great majority of cases, I've been getting along very well with my Jewish patients and colleagues, and that is true. It happens in the cases of other people, too, that I have to criticize the individual, but they don't ascribe it to the fact that they are English, American, or French. However, there's one exception I'd like to mention here, and that is the German. It has happened to me that more than once that when I criticize an individual German, he immediately concludes that I am a hater of Germans. So it is really too cheap to try to hide one's own inferiority behind a political prejudice. So if you perceive my reserved attitude in Ascona as anti-Semitism, you missed the mark completely. I've already told you what gave rise to my attitude then. In your place, I advise you to work towards advancing clarity in this respect. You can refer to the objective results of the Nauheim Congress, which makes it clear beyond all doubt that I can't be an anti-Semite. In general, you really ought to know me well enough not to attribute me uncritically a non-individual stupidity like anti-Semitism. You know well enough to what extent I approach each person as a personality. When I endeavor to lift out of the collective conditioning and make one into an individual, this, as you also know, is only possible if one acknowledges one's particularity with which one is endowed by fate. No one who is a Jew can become a human being without knowing he is a Jew, since this is the basis from which he must reach out towards a higher humanity. This holds true for all nations and races. Nationalism is therefore a conditio sine qua non, no matter how objectionable it is. But the individual must not remain stuck in it. On the other hand, insofar as he is in a particle of the mass of the people, he must not elevate himself above it either. As a human being, I am a European. As an atom of the masses, I am a Swiss bourgeois, domiciled at 228 Zeestrasse, Küsnacht, near Zurich. I hope these explanations are sufficient for you. Otherwise, I'll have to offer you witnesses and references who would testify under oath to the truth of my statement. In judicial language, this is called, quote, probative tenders, unquote. When you see Dr. Neumann, please greet him from me and remind him that I'm waiting to hear from him. Finally, I want to inform you that my new book, Wirklichkeit der Seele, has appeared. I've included in it a Jewish author, an Old Testament psychologist, in order to annoy the National Socialists and all those Jews who have decried me as an anti-Semite. The next thing that will be invented now is that I suffer from a complete absence of convictions and am neither an anti-Semite nor a Nazi. We happen to live in a period which overflows with lunacy. With warm greetings. May 26, 1934. And I read you the whole letter. It's whatever you may think of Jung as as a racist by today's standards, he himself never thought of himself as a racist. I mean, he had, you know, he did. And I have to tell you, this letter, from then on, my dad was a complete defender of Jung for the rest of his life. Yes.
Two things. First, thank you very much for reading that letter. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Hey, what's your thought on what Jung was apologizing for later? What was Jung apologizing for later, after the war?
You know, the language that Jung uses in this article, The Current State of Psychotherapy, is unfortunately very similar to the language that the Nazis were using in their ideology. And so the timing of what Jung was saying was pretty bad. You know, it's like psychotherapy. You can make an interpretation at the wrong time. That can be really pretty damaging.
That was the strongest, made the most sense to me in reading the different stuff, that his timing sucked.
Yeah, it did. It did. It's terrible. Terrible.
Do you want to take a break?
Sure. I need a little. Okay, many people have wondered how Jung's letter could have satisfied my father so completely, so that he became a lifelong convert to Jung. And I can tell you that I know that for a fact. I grew up with it. And I think we have to look at what the situation was like in Europe in the 1930s. Anti-Semitism was endemic in Europe. Even you take a place like Switzerland, which was fairly liberal in that sense, the Jews, and I heard this from Ziggy Hurwitz, The Jews were not allowed in the city walls after nightfall. They had to leave outside. Thank you. Boy, you did that quickly. Outside the city walls. So, and you know, my father had heard rumors, you know, about the Jung becoming a Nazi and speaking on the radio, and you know, and Jung clearly denied all those things, and so my father felt so relieved that he had not gone over to the Nazis, had not met with Hitler, and I can tell you, I've been a Jungian analyst for 45 years, and I'm Jewish, and I've had to answer to psychoanalytic audiences about this question so many times, and I've been, it's as if the fact that I'm Jewish and a Jungian is like that there's something, I must be deranged, because the two should not go together. It turns out that if you look at it in, certainly in the United States, at least 25% of Jungian analysts are Jewish. And I would say in Israel, it's closer to 100%. and I think in many of the European countries, it's not very high, because they're not many Jews left in Europe. I mean, Hitler was pretty successful that way. I'm going to finish with the anti-Semitism issue. If you people are satisfied that you got that full blast from Jung to my dad. You know, it's slightly defensive, it's slightly this, it's slightly that, but he was emotional. And I mean, frankly, this is the only letter that I know of from that period where Jung states what he felt at the time. Now, the second issue that comes up between my father and Jung is our clinical cases. And the first case that he sees in 1930 or 1929 or 30, here, I'm going to do a couple things. The thing that I want to say, that one of the other things on this Jewish question is there were many other Jewish assimilated German Jews who came to see my father, like Neumann, Gerhard Adler, Heinz Westmann, I can name, just to name a few. The only one who had been raised as an Orthodox Jew was my father. And my father, being the scholar that he was, what I realized from the course, one of the things I realized was that my father taught Jung about Judaism, about Jewish theology. And he was very grateful to have my father as a champion of him when all these accusatory things came out after the war. Now, this is a copy of the letter that Jung writes to my father about this patient who he sees he's having trouble with.
Could you
put
the line up?
Pardon?
The line.
This is a picture of the actual letter that my father received from Jung about this patient. I think it's either 1929 or 1930. She's a very young woman, and by today's standards, we would probably call her borderline. And here's what Jung says about how my father should treat her. He says, the picture is really unsatisfactory and seriously dissociated. In such cases, it is always advisable not to analyze too actively, i.e., let the transference calmly run its course and listen sympathetically. Evidently, the patient needs you as a father, which is how you have to present yourself properly as a father, with admonition, scolding, caring, fatherliness, etc. Not a technical, analytical attitude at all, but an essentially human one. The patient needs you so that she can unify her dissociated personality in your consistency, calm, and security. For now, you must stand by without too many therapeutic intentions. The patient will surely take from you what she needs. Without rectifying her relationship with her father, she also cannot bring her love problem into order. She must first achieve peace with her father, that is, in a human trust relationship. What I find especially interesting about this is that I think what Jung says to my father about how to treat this woman patient is how he treated most of his patients. He did not like to talk about the transference. He liked to have the transference, counter-transference, humming along smoothly in the background, and let's talk about archetypal dreams. And but that wasn't always the case. So he did have to talk about the transference, counter-transference. In fact, I gave a seminar here to JPA maybe 15 years ago on the psychology of the transference. So he certainly did believe in it. Now, I was asked by Shelley about, why did Jung send patients to Tony Wolfe? And, for instance, my father had 60 hours of analysis with Jung and 50 hours of analysis with Tony Wolfe, 70 hours with Liliana Fry, and 25 hours with C.A. Meyer. But the question is that most people who came to Jung were told to go see Tony Wolfe as well. So a lot of Americans, like Joe Wheelwright and Joe Henderson, they came over, they would see Jung 2-3 times a week when they were there, and then they'd see Tony Wolfe 2-3 times a week. So why? Because I've already told you the answer. Jung liked to deal with the archetypal imagery, and then he would like to have Tony Wolfe deal with the personal stuff, the mom, dealing with mother and father and all the kind of more personal psychoanalytic things, which he didn't really want to deal with usually. So, does that help, Shelley? Yes.
They shared cases.
Yeah, they shared cases. And what this brought up was in Zurich, for many, many, many years, the idea of seeing both a man and a woman kind of simultaneously, not in the same hour, but, I did that for myself for three summers. I saw C.A. Meyer, and then the next day I would see Liliana Fry. And it was very interesting to get the different, present the material to both a man and a woman. And so this became a general practice even after Jung died. And it got questioned by Michael Fordham, who thought that this diluted the transference. And there was a big discussion in the Journal of Analytical Psychology about the pros and cons of doing this kind of with what was called multiple analysis. And actually, I presented this to a psychoanalytic meeting, which 1975, and they found it very interesting. Because it's completely taboo in psychoanalysis, and they actually published the article, so they liked it. I mean, they liked the article. Whether they liked doing it, they never did it. But anyway, does that answer your question, Shelley? That's as much as I told Shelley I've written an article on the correspondence between my father and Tony Wolfe as well, and that's in the Journal of Analytical Psychology. And that's a whole other kettle of fish. Well, I don't think they discussed the cases. I think they let each person do his or her own analysis without any discussion. They didn't, you know, talk about the cases. That would be my guess. Any other questions?
They did spend time together.
What?
They did spend time together.
Oh, yes, they did, every Wednesday and Saturday. It was quite common, and they, I mean, who knows what they talked about. What we do know is that Toni Wolfe was born, I mean, this is, to me, pretty amazing. She was born, raised, she had lived and practiced and died in the same house. Can you imagine that in this country? No. So Jung would go over Wednesday after he gave his English seminar, and would go over and have lunch with Toni and her family. That her family being, parents, nephews. I have had contact with two of Toni's nephews when I was writing this paper on her. And they were very cordial and very friendly. And then she often came over for Sunday lunch, which is a big meal in Switzerland. And that was very upsetting to the family members, to the children and grandchildren. So, but she was had free access to the house, and they worked together at Zeestrasse and Küsnacht. And Toni was a good critic of Jung's writings, even though the only thing that she wrote on her own was the four types of femininity. Yes.
When you brought up the transference, it sent me to a question back to your father in a letter that Jung wrote to him in 1934. That's the first time I've heard that letter, and I'm still struggling with it a little bit.
Well, you mean to the patient?
No, I'm sorry, I'm going backwards.
Oh, yeah.
The letter that Jung wrote to your father in response mm-hmm. to your father's questions about his anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
So just now when you it's still hard to imagine how that letter completely satisfied your father. And I wondered how much have you ever, I mean, how much of it was transference, his need to keep Jung as an ideal father figure, that also might have kicked him into this lifelong defense of Jung. I was just kind of wondering.
I wonder about it too. I'm sure it was a lot of. I'm sure there was a lot of transference.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds. It would have been hard.
Yeah, but it did satisfy my father. That's that's the important thing. So, yes.
I'm not sure if it's easily accessible right now, but I'm back at the very beginning. You talked about this paragraph that Jung wrote about relationality or the relational psychology.
Yeah.
There's this one paragraph that would about the field, the third thing mm-hmm. between the patient and the analyst. Do you have, can you find that? Is that anywhere?
September 26, 1934. let me get to September 26, 1934, and I will read you this paragraph. And I think it's probably a good. Well, no, I'm not going to end there, but actually, I was wrong. September 29th.
Close enough.
My memory used to be better than this. This is a letter written to my basically, Jung is still writing about the touchiness of everyone to this Jewish question. And he's also commenting on a lecture that my father gives in Palestine about Jungian psychology, which is an appendix in the book. And then he thanks him for birthday wishes, and then he says, and this is the chapter, this is the paragraph that I think just is amazing. With regard to your patient, and the previous letter that my dad wrote to Jung is missing. It is quite correct to say that her dreams have been induced by you, and he underlines you. The feminine mind is earth which awaits the seed. This is the meaning of transference. The less conscious one always receives spiritual fertilization from the more conscious. Hence the guru in India. This is a very ancient truth. As soon as certain patients start treatment with me, the type of their dreams change. In the deepest sense, all of us do not dream, and this is again italicized, out of ourselves, but out of that which exists between myself and the other.
Sure.
With regard to your patient, it is quite correct to say that her dreams have been induced by you. The feminine mind is earth which awaits the seed. This is the meaning of transference. The less conscious one always receives spiritual fertilization from the more conscious. Hence the guru in India. This is a very ancient truth. As soon as certain patients start treatment with me, the type of their dreams changes. In the deepest sense, all of us do not dream out of ourselves, but out of that which exists between myself and the other. And that, So,
would you care to kind of unpack what you understand about the remark about the feminine mind and the earth moving the water? I don't remember exactly how that was seen, but I'm a little puzzled by what you may have meant by that.
Well, basically, what Jung is talking about is the earth, feminine earth, and that so that something can grow out of the earth, the seed which can grow out of the. This is all symbolic. But this is what happens in analysis, in a deep analysis, is that the seed grows. And the seed, S-E-E-D. The seed. So it's about what happens in... in analysis. Now, what I want to say to you, the next thing is, I loved my father deeply, but I would doubt that I would have ever become a Jungian analyst if it had only been my father. The more natural Jungian, and what amazed me growing up, was the intuition and perceptiveness of my mother. And frankly, I think she was, for many people, the more helpful analyst. Now, what I realize also, though, is that my father was an acquired taste. Huh? Yeah. And that over the years, I learned to really, in fact, the changing opinion of my father happened in the Northwest. It happened at Reed College when I was a junior. And they came up to visit me in the spring break. And I just quietly told a couple of professors that my dad would be willing to give a lecture on Jung. And we had one of the dormitories had a big kind of sitting room. And this was during the spring break, 1955. The room was packed. And I saw my professors, who I respected, respecting what my father was saying. And that was the changing moment that from then on, I began to look positively at what my father did rather than negatively.
So you didn't anticipate when you made this little gift to the college at your father's time, you didn't anticipate that it would be such a draw?
No, not at all. But it was interesting that there was in 1955, there were no Jungian analysts anywhere in the Northwest, and there was just the name of Jung drew this crowd.
They were hungry for it.
Hmm?
I said they were hungry for it, and you are a very fortunate man.
Yeah.
And the father.
See, I studied a lot of philosophy at Reed, and my professor was a metaphysics professor, and I would study a lot of Aristotle and Plato. And my philosophy professor could see immediately the connection between the philosophy and the psychology. And you may or may not know that Jung received an honorary doctorate from Oxford University in 1938 for what they said was making Plato a contemporary, for making him understandable for the contemporary world. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good place to end. Okay?
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.